Welcome to today's Hinckley Forum with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Like Rick said, I am Rebecca, and I will be your host for today. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1969 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships for all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries across the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, our nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. For more information, please visit our office in Osh Room 253 or online at hinckley.utah.edu. The title of today's forum is It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. As Rick mentioned, our guests today are Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein. Thomas Mann is the W. Errol Herrien Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Between 1987 and 1999, he was the Director of Governmental Studies at Brookings. Before that, Thomas was the executive director of the American Political Science Association. Thomas is a noted congressional scholar, and he writes and speaks widely on American politics, policy making, including campaigns, elections, finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Also with us is Norm Ornstein. Norm is a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out, and is an Elections Eve analyst for BBC News. Norm served as co-director of the AEI Brookings Election Reform Project, and he participates in the AEI's Elections Watch series. He served as senior counselor to the Continuity of Government Commission. Norm also led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as McCain-Feingold, that reformed the campaign financing system. In 2004, he was elected as Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Please join me in welcoming our guests.
Thank you, Rebecca. Tom and I will each take about 10 minutes to give an introduction to this so we can have ample time for dialogue. I want to thank Kirk Jowers and the Hinckley Institute on behalf of both of us for having us here. We have not only been longtime friends and collaborators with Kirk, but we are longtime admirers of the Hinckley Institute, which does exactly what we would hope we would find in an institution of higher learning to deal with politics and expand participation. And one of the things we did when we first got here was to have breakfast with a number of the students, including Rebecca, and it was a joy. They're wonderful young people who are going to provide our hope, I think, for helping to clean up this process. We're also delighted to be in this spectacular library. I said at lunch yesterday, I don't know who this Marriott guy was, but he did a very, very nice thing. Of course, wonderful weather here. I woke up early this morning and went outside. It was 82 and foggy, just like Clint Eastwood. of course, many of you saw that seminal moment at the Republican convention. I talked to the one of the advisors for the Obama campaign right afterwards. He said he made my day. We've been through both conventions now. I was in Tampa, Charlotte, of course, right after Tampa, and that itself was an interesting experience. While I was there, I picked up a button. They have all these campaign buttons, and it was a striking and unusual one. It had a picture of Jenna Jameson, who happens to be the best-known and most successful porn star in America, and who's endorsed Mitt Romney. And her statement was, I'm rich. Of course I'm going to vote for Mitt Romney. And I thought as I picked up the button, oh, my God, the porn star vote is has abandoned the Democratic Party. This never would have happened under Bill Clinton. I was also struck in Charlotte on Wednesday night. We had the convention and a number of the seminal speeches, including President Clinton. We had the opening of the NFL season, and we had a new episode of Honey Boo Boo. And I thought, if this doesn't encapsulate all of what America represents, I don't know what does. Of course, Tampa was dominated by the weather and the hurricane, Isaac coming down pretty brutally on the coast. It caused Donald Trump to cancel his heralded appearance at the convention. And I thought, nobody talks about the good things that hurricanes can bring with them. My favorite moment there, though, was when Herman Cain was interviewed about the weather, and somebody asked him whether he remembered Katrina. And he said, I never met her. I had nothing to do with her. There's no proof anywhere. There was a little bit of overreaction, I thought, to the weather. When I saw Rick Santorum at the Tampa Zoo gathering up two of every creature, I thought that's probably going a little bit too far. Of course, the drama coming into it was all about the vice presidential choice. It was a critical moment for Governor Romney. A couple of weeks before he made the choice, his campaign advisor predicted that he would choose an incredibly boring white guy. And Joe Biden said, why not? It worked for Obama. He had a number of options, of course, including many of his rivals in the campaign. There was Rick Perry. I think my favorite moment in his campaign came when he was asked what he would do about the West Bank, and he said he'd bring back free checking. There was Michelle Bachmann. My favorite moment among very many moments there was when she wished Elvis a happy birthday on what turned out to be the anniversary of his death. And, of course, she did come back, and she apologized to Elvis and the entire Costello family. But I must confess secretly I was rooting heavily for Ron Paul. Ron Paul, after all, has endorsed legalizing prostitution and legalizing drugs, and I just wanted to be at the victory party. I like to get you laughing because it's all downhill from this point on. Tom and I have been friends and collaborators on numerous projects focused on trying to help large audiences of different sorts understand American politics and American governance, but also we have worked very hard over many, many decades to try to improve our processes and make them work the way the framers intended. Along the way, we've had projects, some of which have been mentioned, on election reform, on campaign finance, on improving Congress, on trying to deal with the problems of a permanent campaign that moves us away from governance. We've written a number of books. 6 years ago, we had one called The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. And now we have this new one, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, which, by the way, makes a great holiday gift. Any holiday, by the way, birthdays, weddings, confirmations, bar mitzvahs, Mitt's birthday, Ann's birthday, Mary Kay, Huntsman's birthday, you name it, a very good gift. But this is different than what we've done before, to be frank. And we wrote it because we've had a sense of deep unease and almost urgency. In our 40-plus years of being immersed in the politics of Washington, from the quarters of Capitol Hill down Pennsylvania Avenue to the other end, we frankly have never seen it this dysfunctional. And we've seen plenty of dysfunction. We arrived during the trauma over the Vietnam War in 1969. We lived through the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and for those of you who were around at that time, we hadn't seen anything like that since Andrew Johnson, and there was real questions about whether the American polity would survive. We then went through, of course, a lot more up to and including and past the impeachment of Bill Clinton. We know that the American political process is not designed to be smoothly running and wonderful in its operations. The framers understood that it would be messy and contentious, that it would reflect many different viewpoints spread across this huge and extended republic. We have that old saw that you never want to watch laws or sausages being made. But that's why we gave a very deliberate title. Never looks good, but this is even worse than it looks. Because we have deep problems that require urgent action that are going to be traumatic and difficult for Americans. And we are now into something that involves a sharper polarization. It's partisan, it's ideological, but frankly, it's become tribal in nature. And we don't have time here to go into a lot of the details. Let me just say that our parties have evolved in a way over the last 30, 40, or 50 years, and it's hardened now even more than ever, where they're like parliamentary parties. They are pure in their ideological beliefs and the way in which they vote. We do not have a parliamentary system, nor do we have a parliamentary culture. In a parliamentary system, a majority acts. The minority reflexively, deeply, vociferously opposes. Everybody understands that those are the roles, and the minority in opposition does not block the majority from acting, and the public accepts the legitimacy of the actions taken by the government. And they know within a matter of a brief time, a few years, five at most, they'll be able to judge and hold accountable, and they know who to hold accountable. That's not how we operate. That's not the way the framers set up the system. The framers set it up so that we would come together in this vast extended republic, people ranging from rural areas that literally, to use Joe Biden's favorite word, but in this case accurately, that literally would not see other human beings for months at a time, all the way to the most densely packed urban areas that are almost impossible to imagine today. And you'd bring them to a Congress coming from the Latin to come together, not a parliament from the French to speak, because the parliament was an agent of the government in a parliamentary system. They would be together, they would put themselves in other people's shoes, they would have periods of deliberation and debate, and then we'd reach an outcome. And ideally that outcome would, over that deliberation and debate, find a broad, bipartisan leadership consensus so that you could sell people that the short-term pain required to make policy change would pay off with the if-come-maybe of something more in the future. And even if you couldn't reach that consensus, the people who didn't get what they wanted would feel that it was legitimate because they'd had the opportunity to have their say. When you have parliamentary parties in a non-parliamentary system, and you can act, and we had action in the first 2 years of the Obama administration, although it was halting action in part because we've taken it beyond even a parliamentary system in a Senate, which now requires 60 votes for everything, which is not anything we've ever seen in our system before. But when those actions are taken with one side and the other side in bitter, vehement opposition, and then determined to delegitimize the outcomes, you end up with a divided country that doesn't accept those outcomes. And then you can move to, as we've seen this last year and a half, the true nightmare of parliamentary parties in a non-parliamentary system, which is divided government and gridlock. So we have in the 112th the mother of all do-nothing Congresses. Many of you remember or read about in history the famous 80th Congress. Harry Truman ran against it, the do-nothing Congress, and it worked for him. The irony is that that Congress actually was remarkably productive. It gave us the Marshall Plan. You could do that and then go home and that would be enough. And it did many other very significant things. This Congress has passed enacted barely more than 60 bills. Over a third of them are naming post offices or doing other commemorative things. And otherwise, its Marshall Plan is the debt limit debacle that caused the first downgrade of credit in the United States. This is no way to run a country. Partisanship is built into the system. We've had it from the beginning. But now it's tribalism. And it's not, you are adversaries, we may not share what you believe, but after all, we may find common ground and an adversary one day can be your ally the next. Now you're the enemy, and if you're for it, we're against it, even if we were for it yesterday. And we have in our book, which by the way makes a great holiday gift, numerous instances that point this out. Now there's another part of this that gets us into slightly more uncomfortable territory. Over 40 plus years, we have worked to develop reputations as straight shooters who don't take sides. We're not partisans. We don't contribute to campaigns. We don't get involved in that process. But the problem now is not symmetric. If you look, and there's lots of data that show what's happened to the parties, they've divided ideologically. The Democrats have moved to a position where they are center-left, and the Republicans have moved to a position which is beyond conservative now. It's not conservative anymore. It's almost radical in its nature. You've seen some examples of this in Ground Zero here in Utah. Bob Bennett had one of the most conservative voting records, but he was a problem solver. And now we're replacing problem solvers with others. And when you get a vehement opposition, the way this has operated, it is not healthy in a society that needs answers to deep-seated questions. Longer-term questions, whether they involve how we're going to have a workforce that will actually be productive when large numbers of young people can't even get on a career ladder because of unemployment, where others are going to be unemployed for long periods of time, and if they're in their 50s or 60s, may never be able to find something comparable to what they've had. A debt problem, but also a short-term economic situation where if you move too fast to solve the debt problem, you'll end up like Europe. All of those things, along with challenges from abroad, require something closer to what the framers had in mind. And we want two vibrant, active political parties. One of them is going to be proudly conservative. The other won't. They'll go at it hammer and tong. If they don't share the same set of facts, and if they don't go at it with a spirit that, yes, we want to win, but we're here to solve problems, then we're going to be forced to do the next book, which will be Run for Your Lives. We don't want to do that. And we don't want to get in a situation, as our friend John McCain often says, where it's always darkest just before it turns completely black. We want the opposite, and we know all of you do, too. And what we want is problem solvers back. We need a broad problem-solving caucus, and half of our book is dedicated to looking at ways to try and make this process work better and to change our culture. Tom.
Well, you can see what it's like to have as your sidekick a stand-up comic, huh? Not only that, he stole my best lines about the book. I am just thrilled to be back on the campus of the university at the Marriott Library and back as a Hinckley Fellow. I have visited the Institute on a number of occasions and spoken at the university. I just have such enormous regard for its design and execution of really helping people engage in the political process. Delighted. From Rebecca, we learned, we even have a campaign management element of this program. Now, that may have given some people in the audience pause. So you're the ones that teach people how to run super PACs and raise multi-million dollar money. You're the ones who come up with these egregiously untruthful and vicious public ads, but I know that's not what you teach. You know here in the state of Utah with great traditions, you probably go back to the old campaign techniques, the ones that I was introduced to, even ones that sort of tried to bridge the world of religion and politics. What I think of is the time that Father Robert Drynan, a liberal Jesuit priest and law professor at Boston College, decided to run for the House of Representatives. It turned out it was a tough race, and the action was in the primary, but he didn't have money for ads, and there weren't any sort of super PACs around, so he conceived of and executed a bumper sticker. Remember the days of bumper stickers? And it read, "Vote for Drinan or go to hell." Ah, those are the good old days. Listen, I'm also gratified to see you all here. It's a wonderfully large and welcoming audience, and it's important because in the end, you're going to have to solve this problem. Norman and I can try to identify the nature of our dysfunctional politics to try to outline how it developed over time, how it's manifest, and offer some ideas from political electoral reform to institutional reforms to ideas like creating a public square at a time of a deeply partisan press on the right and the left. We can try to reintroduce the notion of public shame. So when prominent people outside of politics make outrageous statements, we call them on it. We need leadership from citizens to sort of speak up and say what's wrong and what makes sense of not rewarding people who lie, get called on it, and then double down and do it even more because it seems to work with the swing voters. So in the end, we have an angry public, but a confused public. I mean, I hear time and again, why don't those folks in Washington just get together and do the right thing? It's a sort of an understandable sense of that people express, and yet I think it reflects a lack of understanding of what is actually going on in our politics and why it will take more than pleas to get along together and let's hold hands around the campfire. It's going to take something much more than that. One of the biggest problems you have is figuring out who to hold accountable. Norm discussed this peculiar situation now with parliamentary-like parties, you know, ideologically polarized and vehemently oppositional, but operating in our own separation of power system. So you create incentives for the opposition party to undermine the efforts of the majority that's been sanctioned by the most recent election to put its program in place. If you have no interest in participating in the policy process, but you have the resources and the incentives to undermine it, you can advance your political interests, but the damage is inflicted on the country as a whole. And that's what's been happening in our politics, and our system makes it so much more difficult because we elect the president and the House and Senate separately. We have midterm elections 2 years in, and as we saw in 2010, the best way for the minority party to advance was to sort of try to bollocks up the process, limit the stimulus, discredit what was done, and then blame the president's party for not improving the economy. It really does sort of set up a perverse incentive. It makes it exceedingly difficult for us to know who to hold accountable. The separate elections, the midterm, and then, of course, the difficulty of empowering a minority to prevent a majority to work its will and to embrace a program that responds to promises made during the campaign. If this were a parliamentary system, I'd say to the Republicans, you're a terrific opposition party. Raise holy hell, you know, say how bad their programs are. Do anything you want, and then sit down, and the majority will adopt its government's program. But in our case, they really are in a position, mainly through the routinization of the filibuster, which gave us something our framers never anticipated, was a routine 60-vote requirement to get anything done in the institution. And what goes along with that, of course, is the individual hold, which can keep any action from transpiring for a very long time. It's a huge mismatch we have, and citizens have got to figure out how to work their way through. Just throwing the bums out fix it all up? Does electing people who promise not to be politicians but to stand by their principles and not compromise, is that going to fix it? We don't think so. We think somehow our goal is to return to an era, and there is no golden era in American politics. We would never claim that. We've been through difficult periods like this in the past, but we desperately need two strong, vibrant, differing political parties, but operating in a problem-solving fashion within the mainstream of American politics, who don't feel the pressure to be in a constant state of political war, not just 24/7, 52 weeks. It's day in and day out from year one through two, three, four, and beyond. That's the difficulty. And it's now reinforced by another reality. We as a country have been engaged in a big sort. We have moved to neighborhoods with like-minded people who look alike and share our values and positions in life roughly. This has created sort of clusters of like-minded people around the country. You don't have to gerrymander districts to get those that will elect only a very conservative Republican or a liberal Democrat. And it's then you add on top of that the media, the partisan media, and the way in which it reinforces what people already believe and tells them lies that they accept as truth and then pass on, and you have a very unhealthy process. Sadly, the press exacerbates the problem, the new media, but the old media isn't doing such a great job either. That is, in spite of strong norms of professionalism and great talent in the reporting profession, the pressure from producers and editors to always be balanced, even if it's an artificial balance, that is, the object is to avoid criticism of having a partisan or ideological bias, and there are critics on both sides who will jump on them. As a result, the message you hear is they're all in it. They're both the same. You know, they're all corrupt. They're all crooks. They're all playing the same game. Well, it's not quite true. Yeah, all of them are politicians, and thank God for that. As Norm said, that's what the framers were. But it turns out there are big differences right now in our politics between our parties. They're different. They bear different degrees of responsibility. It would have, had we spoken 30 years ago, it would have been a different portrayal of the place of our parties, but that's the reality that we confront today. So that's what our book is about. It really is even worse than it looks because we don't understand that it's supposed to look messy and bad, but it's not supposed to operate like this. and we need to get to the heart of the matter and to proceed through a host of institutional reforms, but most immediately, most importantly, for citizens to take a moment or two or three or even a few hours and to try to figure out what this game is, what people are saying, what the constant spin is, and see where to put your support and engagement and to do what you can to right the American party system and diminish this dysfunctional politics. I think we'll do it. I'm inherently an optimist. It's true what John McCain says about that blackness, but I could point to three periods in our history just as difficult or more difficult and similar in many ways. We're going to get out of it, but this isn't the time to take 10 or 20 years to do it. Let's get on it now. Thank you very much.
We're going to open up questions now. If you do have a question, please state your name, speak directly into the microphone, and just give a brief introduction to yourself.
My name is Noel Dean Evers. We all know who the extreme right are and what it is they want to do because they won the 2010 elections. Who are the extreme left and what is it they want to do?
You know, what's fascinating is the closest thing to an extreme left is Occupy Wall Street. This is a movement that is really responding to growing levels of economic inequality in income and wealth, which is a reality. And so in many respects, it's not very liberal. It's pointing out a reality that we last experienced in the Gilded Age. It was also a period of great inequality. And Teddy Roosevelt, a famous Republican president, sort of led the charge for a series of changes, both in the role of money in politics, but also in a set of governmental institutions that would help deal with many of these problems. There are sort of individual left-wing activists. You can find them on the web, but what's striking is they're not players in the National Democratic Party. They're not having any influence. Since Bill Clinton, you saw those in the 60s and 70s in particular, but since Bill Clinton sort of re-centered the Democratic Party after years of losing presidential elections, the Democratic Party has just become more pragmatic. And there are members advancing much more ambitious policy agendas, but they don't control the party. they are voices out there. Some of them think we're insane not to have a single-payer healthcare system. They think our form of taxation is ridiculously unfair and insufficient to deal with the responsibilities of government. There are many such people out there, but if you look at anything that has transpired in the last 3 years in the Congress and the Democratic agenda, you'd have a hard time identifying a single thing where, if you will, the left-wing forces in the party called the shots. They pretty much lost all of their battles.
Yes, I'd like to just thank you for being here and also for the wonderful book. I want to make a comment on your angry and confused public. I think the public has been angry and confused for nearly a decade. And I think it's moved beyond that now. I've been traveling this state for the last 6 months, running for Congress. And I'm finding, you can almost see people's eyes when you talk to them, that they've gone beyond confusion. They're scared.
They're afraid of the future. They sense that everything that's been their foundation in this society and in this culture is starting to crumble. They can't extrapolate kind of stepwise from yesterday and today into the near future, because they know that that future is going to be dramatically different, politically, economically, and so forth. And so I'd just like your perspective, if you're sensing any of that anywhere else, that the confusion and angriness is now moving toward real fear and uncertainty, and what the implications of that might be.
It's a very good question, and it's for those who didn't hear, it's an angry and confused public that's gone beyond it into a real fear about the future. And there's no question there's an enormously high level of pessimism about the short term, and for many about the medium and long term, a sense that this may be the first generation in so many where we can't say that our children are going to be better off than our generation has been. Let's face it, a part of it and a part of our political distemper right now is because we are in the midst of an economic trauma that's different from any we have seen in most of our lifetimes. This is an economic downturn caused by a financial crisis. There's a wonderful book by two economists looking at 800 years of human history and economics called This Time It's Different. And it basically says when you look at crises caused by financial collapses, what happens is they last much longer than the typical recession. You end up with huge debt problems. There's government debt, there's private sector business debt, there's individual debt. You've got to deleverage that debt, but if you try to do it in the midst of a recession, you turn it into a depression. It's the equivalent of the medieval practice of bleeding an anemic patient, and we know where that goes. So you've got to find a way to stimulate in the short run, which adds to your debt, and then make a nice pivot to deal with that long-term problem. But it can take years. It's like the Japanese lost decade. And it also means that unemployment persists for a long time. You get into that situation and you don't have an immediate plus, or you don't have it even in 3 or 4 years, and people don't know if they're ever going to have it. And if you add to that the tribalism and the rhetoric that we get and the sharp divisions, and we know we get populism that emerges out of this. And it's populism on the left, that's the Occupy movement. It's populism on the right, which led to the Tea Party movement. All of that makes it tougher. It's part of why we feel this sense of urgency as well. And part of the frustration is, frankly, if we had seen the parties come together in the super committee, you know, this was the political equivalent of the Avengers, a superpowers and the ability to do something. When that collapses, because fundamentally, basically, Grover Norquist stood in the way of an agreement, if we had managed to come through with a plan, even a faulty, halting one, but that would have reduced the debt by $4 trillion over 10 years, but taken a little bit of time and in the short run enabled us to stimulate, we wouldn't be here talking about this in the same way. But we are, and we have to make sure that voters who want to hold accountable the miscreants but aren't quite sure who the miscreants are and tend, as both of us have said, to throw out the wrong people and then bring in even worse.
Two questions. The psychologist Jonathan Haidt has a new book out. You're familiar with it. The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. In an interview in American History magazine this month, it's indicated that he's arguing that we will stay polarized as a society until we try to understand the opposing side's moral point of view. What do you think about that? And my second question is, Norm, where do you get your material from?
Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, is one of the best books I've read in many years, and it really makes you think. And it's basically, he is a psychologist who's trying to find where our moral reasoning comes from, and looks at it, and looks at a lot of research, but also looks at liberals and conservatives and the different things, taste buds, in effect, that they have. And I've talked to him at length, He actually often references our book because he wants to find a way around this and has some ideas in which to do so. But of course, it's an important part of this. And it's, again, it gets back to the framers. The framers said you've got to look at other people's points of view. You have to understand where they're coming from and accept that there's a lot of legitimacy in what they're saying. I will tell you, I have a lot of sympathy for a Tea Party movement that formed as people became frustrated with what they saw as leaders who were not doing their job and want to solve a lot of these problems. And in a way, getting back to the first question about the extreme left and the extreme right, the Tea Party movement is a leaderless movement by and large, but they organized to get candidates to actually try to implement and affect the political process. And while some of what they're doing, which includes now trashing some of the Tea Party members because they've gone Washington, which means they voted for something, is a frightening one, the Occupy movement is there to occupy. They don't seem to have anything but a diffuse notion of it. But for all of that, if you don't understand where people are coming from, why they feel that fear and frustration, if you don't understand why people are offering points of view that may not lead in an appropriate direction in policy, and if you can get them at least to begin to focus on some facts and then look at where you can have solutions, we're going to have a problem. And what we find, even with the two of us, and what you see everywhere is now people start with, well, who is this person and where is he coming from? Yeah. If he's from the American Enterprise Institute, I'm not going to listen to a thing that he said because I know what they're like. Or if he's from Brookings, it's the same thing. And that is really pernicious and destructive in the society. And as I say, and as we've both said, we don't want at this point to have a Republican Party blown off the face of the earth. We want back the Republican Party that is a proudly conservative party, that is a problem-solving party. That, in fact, is a model that Utah has represented for so long and still does in many ways at the state level, but it's starting to bleed over into a situation where it's going to be people like, you don't have to tell me the facts. I've got my own facts, and I know what's right, and you're wrong because of who you represent, and we're going to blow you out of the water, never mind compromising with you.
Jonathan Haidt has identified the problem and said what we have to do, but doesn't really get, well, how do we do that? That's why I talked about the big sort, how we're pulling ourselves back into like-minded communities, and there are fundamental value differences. Fascinating research on this. It's sort of, you know, the role of hierarchy and traditionalism, you know, versus sort of individualism. It's complicated. And Cass Sunstein, this sort of marvelous lawyer and legal scholar who's been in the government trying to fix up the regulatory process, has done these experiments, and it just demonstrates that if you put together a group that's like-minded and bring in someone who's not quite sure, that individual gravitates to the poll. If you manage to have a more diverse group to begin with, then the possibilities of meaningful exchange actually exist.
As long as you have computers that can narrowly define voting districts so that only only the partisans of a party can be elected. As long as those voting districts are so narrow, how do you combine people of different viewpoints into a district and vote for people?
Well, it's good that that you raise that. Partisan gerrymandering is certainly a reality of our life, and we can walk to individual states and see when one party controls the governorship and the state legislatures, they're likely to manipulate the districts to work to their advantage. There's some natural self-correcting forces at work, because if they try too hard to increase their numbers as opposed to the level of safety of a smaller number of their own partisans, then they move some districts into the more competitive range. Nonetheless, we've been actively involved in projects having to do with legislative redistricting. We believe in trying to remove the politicians from the role of drawing their own districts. This is a general problem in America, you should realize. It's different than virtually every other democracy. We don't allow nonpartisan officials to mediate and administer our elections. We have partisan election officials who are sometimes, while being Secretary of State, are also chair of a presidential election campaign in their own states, and therefore the pressures to deliver for your side, to diminish the integrity of the rules, be they election law rules or the campaign finance system, or redistricting, are just very powerful. And we somehow have to break against that norm, begin to find a role for nonpartisan officials and, frankly, citizen commissions of various kinds to police what is a set of forces driving the partisanship that damages our politics.
Let me add to that just a couple of things. It wasn't gerrymandered districts that got Bob Bennett into a position where he couldn't even run for his own party's nomination. It wasn't a gerrymandered set of districts that had Dick Lugar bounced or that had Arlen Specter switch parties because he couldn't win a nomination in his own party. Here it was a loony caucus system thank goodness that the Hinckley Institute has moved to both try to change that but also to dramatically increase the participation. A part of what we want to do, the redistricting has changed the culture. It's given more power to the extremes, low turnout primaries, but it also, you know, can be exacerbated by caucuses that don't work. We want to expand the electorate. If we had our druthers, we would expand the electorate by having the Australian system of mandatory attendance at the polls. In Australia, both bases turn out, and the politicians focus on the voters in the middle. You don't have manipulation of those bases. If we can't do that, we'd like a lottery, where your lottery ticket is your vote stub. And if we can't do that, and even if we could, we want open primaries. We want to make it much easier for people to vote. We want preference voting so that if there are third or fourth parties, they don't distort the process, where if you're going to vote for an independent or a third party, or in any other case, you have a second choice that counts in an instant runoff. There are a lot of mechanisms that we could employ to try and reduce the power of the extremes on both sides and give more clout to the larger mass of voters. And let me tell you, we better do that soon, because the tribalism in Washington is already metastasized to the states, and it's really starting to affect the public as a whole. And it may be at a point before too long where people are so identified with one side or the other that you're not going to be able to shake this. And then you're going to have a society that, if it makes decisions and half the country automatically assumes they are illegitimate, or if we have, God forbid, another election like 2000, and believe me, it is very much a possibility, we're not going to have an outcome where the side that loses, even if it won the popular vote, swallows hard and says, all right, let's move on. You're going to have people in the streets. That is not a desirable outcome.
If Barack Obama gets another 4 years, are we to be optimistic about what the Congress is able or will be willing to accomplish in the next 4 years? How ingrained is this, and, you know, will Mitch McConnell's goal of limiting him to a single term be frustrated? Will things get better as a result of that?
That's an excellent and extremely important question. To answer it, first you have to tell me what's going to happen in the elections for the House and the Senate. Presidents don't govern. We greatly exaggerate the impact of presidents on the state of the economy and many other things, but on critical domestic policy legislation, who controls the House and the Senate and what the margins are is exceedingly important. So if you tell me he gets reelected barely, but the Republicans hold the House and take the Senate, my guess is the interpretation within the party is it's all Romney's fault. He wasn't really one of us. He was a Massachusetts moderate and just trying to act like us, but his heart wasn't in it, so we may have to double down. So that could be a serious problem. What I do think is that, number one, if the Democrats hold the Senate, take control of the House, I think there are greater opportunities for addressing the whole host of problems, but you're still going to come up against the Senate. My own view is Democrats are on the verge of taking the step, what's called the constitutional option, to limit the filibuster in some respects, if only to put the burden of delaying a vote on a matter on the minority to constantly maintain 41 votes against cloture in order to keep a filibuster going and not put all of the burden on the majority to get the 60 votes they need. So you could see more action even if there was just absolute Republican opposition. But I think, picking up on something Norm said earlier, there are a number of Republicans in the Senate whose instincts, natural instincts, are problem solving. Tennessee has two of them, Corker and Alexander, and there are others. And it seems to me with this tremendous advantage, 23 Democratic Senate seats up, only 10 Republican, if they blow it and lose it, it seems to me there are a number who don't want to play four more years of pure opposition, pure, you know, warfare and obstruction, and some possibilities exist for actually pulling them into some serious negotiations. The second important point is the blessing of the fiscal cliff is that the status quo is not acceptable to either party, as in some ways it was when Obama was elected. The expiration of the tax cuts, the imposition of sequestration of spending on both sides, and the looming deficit and debt problems over the intermediate long term all require some action. I think Obama's negotiating opportunities would increase. I'm guessing the signal he sent in his speech in Charlotte that he would embrace the framework of the Bowles-Simpson Commission to deal with our deficit and debt problems, provide an opportunity for action that were simply not possible, say, after the 2010 election.
Hi, my name is Tony. Is this on? Okay, yeah, my name is Tony. To switch to the media aspect of your book, you aren't entirely kind to the media, too. You have, you know, Fox, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck. On the other side, you have, you know, Lawrence O'Donnell, Rachel Maddow, Joe Scarborough in the Morning with Mika Brzezinski. That's an interesting combination. So my understanding is that you published this book, and I've been following what's been going on. You publish this book, and there's absolutely no media attention to it whatsoever. And then you write an op-ed piece saying, look, we wrote this important book, and it does, in fact, kind of indict the Republican Party, and no one's paying attention to it. And now all of a sudden, some of the more middle of the road, CNN, Meet the Press or something, it starts having you on. And then you get on to many other shows. And I was just wondering, having lived through the fact that you published the book and the dead silence it was greeted with, if I understood how that played out, and then being asked to come on,
Do you now have an understanding of what happened, why there might have been that resistance? And having been on these shows, did you ever hear from them why they didn't invite you on in the first place? And then my final question is, when you appeared on The Daily Show, was Jon Stewart like the coolest, the best appearance of all?
Yeah, that's a good set of questions. Your understanding isn't quite right. We did an op-ed in the Washington Post, which was taken from the book the day before the book was published. And that opinion piece, which was a long piece, it was almost 3,000 words, that the editor, to give it maximum exposure, titled, let's just say it, the Republicans are the problem, just exploded. It went on the web. It's published on Sunday. It went on the web Thursday afternoon. By Friday afternoon, they'd had more than 5,000 comments on their page, and they stopped counting after that point. We've had 256,000 Facebook referrals and 1.5 million web hits. So it became the topic of discussion in Washington that Sunday and throughout the next couple of weeks, and the book took off. And we got a lot of media attention. We had a long interview with Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour. We had a terrific interview on Morning Edition on public radio. We did a number of television shows. But what a number of people noticed was the Sunday shows, which most of them are an hour now, and the second half hour they bring panels on, and mostly their role is talk about what everybody's talking about. And nobody talked about it. And that happened for weeks. Then we got on a Sunday show, which was the show that Chris Hayes does on MSNBC, which, you know, when we first got the invitation, we said, this is great. Literally dozens of people will hear about this. It actually happens to be a wonderful show. This is one of these incredibly bright guys who does his homework, and you get in depth into some issues. But we have never heard from Meet the Press, Face the Nation this week, interestingly enough, because half of that op-ed piece was taking the media to task for not doing their job of reporting what's actually going on out there. Howard Kurtz has a show on every Sunday on the media, and we haven't heard from him. And the reason it's become clear is obvious. If you bring on people, instead of doing what they love to do on the Sunday shows, which is you got somebody from the left and somebody from the right, and if they're not ideologues, you get some cynical party spinner from the left with the other cynical party spinner. And, mainstream media heaven, you've got James Carville and Mary Madeline, and so you've covered all of your bases. But if you begin to get into a discussion that suggests maybe what you should be doing is not just reporting both sides as if they're equal every time, where sometimes there are 12 sides, but often they're not both sides, then you're going to get criticized heavily. And talk about people who can dish it out but can't take it. It's the mass media. And now, frankly, if you get labeled in some way as biased, you worry about your advertising in this new media world. And all of that is a huge problem out there. And, you know, it's not just saying, all right, here's one party that's more responsible than the other. It's, you know, to be frank, we've got 99.5% of scientists out there who say there is such a thing as climate change and it's a problem, and you got one half of 1% who say it isn't. You could say the Earth is round and you're going to find one half of 1% of scientists who say, well, that's not really been proven. But if you treat them both as equal and every time you have a discussion you bring on one from one side and one from the other, what's the public to believe? So it is a much larger problem in our discourse even than politics. But convincing a mass media that is either partisan now with the business models that work to make Fox and MSNBC thrive. Fox, with an audience at any given time of 2.5 million people, makes more in net profits than all three network news divisions with an audience of 30 million people combined. That's what works. Then you've got the others. And if the others aren't doing their job, and each side is spinning madly, you are left with a worse situation, and we have not cracked through there. When we wrote this op-ed piece, we got emails and calls from some of the best reporters in the business saying, thank you for doing this. We are trying,
But our editors tell us, oh, no, your job is to report both sides, or we're not going to get into that thicket. And, you know, CNN, unlike Fox and MSNBC, has no business model. So they're the ones who either bring on somebody on the left screaming at somebody on the right, or the two cynical spinners. And the public looks at that and thinks there is no middle, and they're all, you know, nobody's honest about this. They all lie and spin anyhow. It's just not healthy.
Just to underscore that point, there are so many good reporters. You can sort of abide by professional norms of sort of fairness and honesty, integrity. Many are our friends. Most of them are frustrated by the conventions they have to adopt now out of fear of charges of partisan bias or discontent among advertisers and owners and other things. It's their job is made so much more frustrating, and some resist it. I can reel off names of reporters for the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, who sort of fight it, but they're just trapped right now. And I mean, what our hope is that by talking about it, if not on the Sunday talk shows here and elsewhere, that it will begin to provide them with the help they need to forge a better set of conventions at their news organizations.
Word on John Stewart. John Stewart actually embarrasses the mainstream press on a regular basis because he's got a fantastic staff that holds accountable organizations. He puts up the video of what Fox or MSNBC have done and shows
or
sometimes.
CNN.
And, you know, I just remember a moment where on the Fox and Friends morning show, Steve Doocy picked up the talking points from the Republican Party that he'd been given and said, now here's what we're supposed to be talking about. And his co-host just, you know, daggers. You're not supposed to say that. But John Stewart read our book and did plenty of funny stuff in it, but it was a substantive interview where he pushed back a significant amount. He and Stephen Colbert are smarter than most of the reporters we deal with on a daily basis. They've got incredible talent, but it's no great surprise that lots of people turn to them as their major news sources, even though they keep saying, don't you people realize we are fake news? But you know, if you're going to watch Stewart, you have to know something about what's going on in the world, so I'm happy with that.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank as well everyone who came today, certainly the Marriott Library, their excellent director and staff. It's been wonderful working with them. We work on a number of projects. September Project is something we always do together, and we greatly appreciate it. Tom and Norm will be signing books immediately following this right here in this auditorium, so urge you to stick around for that. And as a final thank you, I would like to, if you wouldn't mind coming up, one last job. they've done about 50 things in their time here with us. But the Hinckley Institute's highest award is the Hinckley Fellow. And recently we've honored General Brent Scowcroft, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, who's been with us a number of times, presidential nominee Mitt Romney, former Supreme Court Justice Dallin A. Jokes, and now Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein is this year's Hinckley Fellows. Thank you so much for everything you've done. Thank you.